Isaiah chapters 46 and 47. Now in our studies in the second half of Isaiah, we are drawing near to the end of the first part of the second half. The next chapter, 48, which we'll look at in a fortnight, God willing, ends the first part of the second half of Isaiah, 40 to 66. After which, from chapter 49, any preoccupation with Cyrus is replaced by the superior theme of the servant of the Lord himself, Messiah. But here in chapters 46 and 47, the chief preoccupation is with the gods of Babylon and the city of Babylon itself as to its future doom, which is predicted here. But you see, to understand the fury of God's wrath against Babylon, we need to know something of that great city and the empire it gathered round it. There was, of course, ancient Babylon, which goes back to the dim distance of primeval man. But this Babylon was said to have been founded by the god of Babylon, Bel, also called Baal, and also called Marduk, who, along with another god, Nebu, nothing to do with Moses Mountain, Nebu, Bel and Nebu, ruled that proud empire until long after Cyrus, the kingdom faded away forever. And we want to read the end of the kingdom of Babylon, and Babylon as a type of all ungodly cities. You read the book of the Revelation, chapters 17 and 18, and you will see something there. We'll look at a part of that perhaps later on. Now, this Babylon, as a proud empire, lasted for something like 77 years, whereas its predecessor, Assyria, had survived for almost 250 years. But there's no comparison between the kingdoms. Assyria remained an uncultured blunderbuss among the nations she devoured. Whereas Babylon, on the other hand, became a world center of culture. Her gods were writing gods. They were the gods of the intellectuals, the astrologers, you see, the scholars of that part of the world, known, of course, much later on under the Persians. Babylon's city bestrode the great river Euphrates with a bridge connecting its two parts, something like Budapest, if you know anything about that great city. Two cities joined together across the river, Budapest. Well, Babylon was a bit like that, with this great bridge, and its walls were 60 miles in circumference, encompassing a most regularly constructed series of streets and roads, perhaps as four square as New York City, if you've been there and seen it. Babylon's hanging gardens, you remember, were one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It was therefore a place of phenomenal pride. And, of course, you see how proud a monarch Nebuchadnezzar was. If you read one verse in Daniel, listen to this. Nebuchadnezzar says, "Is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power for the glory of my majesty?" But then, if I read on, you would remember that the words were still on his lips when a voice came from heaven saying, "This is what is decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals, and you will eat grass like cattle." But that was his boast, you see. But you see, for all her pride, she had much to answer for, very much. Nebuchadnezzar is called in three places in the prophecy of Jeremiah, is called the servant of the Lord. Jeremiah 25:9, Jeremiah 27:6, Jeremiah 43:10. Nebuchadnezzar is called the servant of the Lord. But he was not the servant of the Lord to please or oblige the Lord. Nothing like that. For Nebuchadnezzar sent time and again to Jerusalem to steal away the choicest of her sons as slaves to adorn the gorgeous capital of his phenomenal empire, to satisfy his vanity. And his vanity would have been particularly satisfied, you see, by stealing away the choicest of the sons of the formerly great little kingdom of Israel, Solomon's kingdom, you see, so that he might furnish his kingdom with flunkies from the royal house of Judah to adorn his bloated royal court. However, the Lord in these two chapters we've been reading, as usual taking a long, long view, which we need to do as believers, as Christians, the Lord in these two chapters looks forward with a certain amount of menace, mind you, and yet with eventual hope to the more favorable expectations of his wayward people Israel. Not only beyond the day of their captivity when they're taken away to Babylon, for they're not there yet, of course, but to the return home at the hands of Cyrus, and the Lord seeing right through to that, and thereafter indeed. The Lord sees what he will begin to do to proud Babylon. And that's much later than Cyrus. For Cyrus, you see, having captured the city, dwelt in it, but heartily despised it. And from Cyrus's time onwards, the city of Babylon declined until 200 years later on, in Alexander the Great's day, it had become so dilapidated and ruinous that Alexander gave up trying to rebuild and restore Babylon. It was hopeless. And Babylon has been, comparatively speaking, a heap of ruins of sand ever since to this day, as the Lord predicted. Listen to this from Jeremiah. So desert creatures and hyenas will live there, and the owl will dwell again, be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation, as God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah along with their neighboring towns, declares the Lord. So no one will live there, and no man will dwell in it. Because, of course, she had very much to answer for. very much to answer for. And so this is the background to our chapters. And as we've seen, chapter 46 opens with weary beasts of burden laden with the golden gods of Babylon, Bel and Nebo, being casted away to God knows where, but certainly to complete oblivion. Even the animals, as they trudged their way out of ruined Babylon, seemed to suggest the hopeless end of that ruined city. Can't you see? You need our God has an ironic sense of humor, you know. And you need to exercise that when you're reading the scriptures. Can't you see the lifeless heads of these images staring incomprehensibly from the backs of these poor beasts as they are borne away from that once glorious city? Those gods that they bowed down to, including the king, and worshipped and appealed to when they went away to battle. Listen to this from the book of the Revelation. I mentioned that we would look at the book of the Revelation, chapters 17 and 18. Let me read with you, and you can turn up if you like. Revelation 17 and 1. Revelation 17. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. With her the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries." Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand, filled with the abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. This title was written on her forehead: "Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth." I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. Ah, but then look at the 18th chapter and the fourth verse, 18 and 4. "Then I heard another voice from heaven say, 'Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues. For her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes. Give back to her as she has given. Pay her back double for what she has done. Mix her a double portion from her own cup.'" Verse 11, "The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones, and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, and scarlet cloth, every sort of citron wood, and articles of every kind made of ivory, costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble, cargoes of cinnamon and spice, of incense, myrrh, and frankincense, of wine and olive oil, of fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and carriages, and bodies and souls of men." They will say, "The fruit you longed for is gone from you. All your riches and splendor have vanished, never to be recovered. The merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off, terrified at her torment. They will weep and mourn and cry out, 'Woe, woe, O great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls.' in 1 hour such great wealth has been brought to ruin. But you see, the prophet at chapter 46 and 3 sees another burden bearer than those beasts bearing the gods. And the contrast between these poor beasts with their pathetic burdens and this great burden bearer is absolutely complete. This is the eternal burden bearer himself, who has borne his chosen people since the beginning of their call, since they were conceived. Now, what does that mean? Doubtless, that goes back at least as far as Abraham, albeit we may even think back to Abel and Seth and Enoch and Noah. But there, he has borne his chosen people since the beginning of their call, since they were conceived, and he will carry them forever, even through captivity for their sins and dispersion for nearly 2,000 years for rejecting Jesus Christ. He will carry them until A.D. 1948. He brought many of them back to their very own land. Even to old age and gray hairs, he will be their God. And as the psalmist says, listen to this, what the psalmist says: the righteous will flourish like a palm tree. They will grow like a cedar of Lebanon, planted in the house of the Lord. They will flourish in the courts of our God. They will still bear fruit in old age. They will stay fresh and green to proclaim that the Lord is upright. He is, says the psalmist, he is my rock, and there is no wickedness in him. Promising them fruitage to their old age, because God will not change his word concerning his chosen people. It's beautiful, isn't it, how he puts it, reminding us, doesn't it, of chapter 40 and these enchanting words? You heard the music from Handel at the beginning of the service. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers them in his arms and carries them in his bosom close. One of the translations is very beautiful. Carries them in his bosom close to his heart. He gently leads those who are with young. But here, you see, he means his words of assurance that Israel is to be his people forever. He means his words of assurance to be cherished against trials that are yet to come. For you see, as we look forward, and I'm reminding you that the prophet has the long view here. He is saying to them, we must look right through many trials to these glories that are to be. We must cherish his words of assurance against all trials to come, for it is going to take a long time for proud Babylon to be dismantled. He pictures Babylon again from verse 6, you see, of chapter 46. And this time, it's the people of Babylon themselves who are shouldering their gods of gold. because these bits of precious metal cannot move themselves, being lifeless images. Remember this, he says to his own people in view of this. Remember this and take it to heart, the Lord is saying to his wayward people. I make known the end from the beginning, and my purpose will stand. I make known the end from the beginning. He then characterizes Cyrus as a rara avis, a rare bird of prey from the east, who is going to help Judah back home to Jerusalem. But you see, now with that horrid captivity in Babylon still ahead of them, and the Lord's scorn of these objects of heathenism because of their of Israel's persistent backsliding idolatry, he warns them, listen to me, you stubborn-hearted, far from righteousness. I am bringing my righteousness near. It is not far away, and my salvation will not be delayed. I will grant salvation to Zion, my splendor to Israel. And so he turns back to Babylon again, the city this time, which he portrays as the daughter of Babylon, although these daughters are a figure, I believe, for the city which is to be dismantled, her nakedness absolutely exposed. The city is to be reduced to its foundations. No secret of Babylon will remain hidden when disaster overtakes the proud city. Come and sit in the dust, he says to them. And of course you get the same humiliating message in these long chapters that we looked at earlier, Jeremiah chapters 50 and 51, and also in Revelation 17 and 18. Now, if you are really interested in this history from a spiritual point of view, you will read through today at some point Jeremiah chapters 50 and 51, and that'll take a little time. They're long, long chapters. And also Revelation 17 and 18. And a whole lot that I'm trying to say now will come alive to you in a new way. And so the Lord goes on to recall in chapter 47 what Nebuchadnezzar did to the Lord's people when the Lord, he says, was angry with his people for their sins. These Babylonians thought they were it and would continue forever. Go on then, he calls to them, sneering at them. Go on then, continue your magic spells and the counsels of your astrologers and stargazers. Let them say what the future will hold if they can. Well, we might say, had you thought of this while we were reading about these Babylonian astrologers and stargazers? Did this occur to any of you? They won't foretell this, that descendants of these very astrologers and stargazers in a much later day were going to see a particular star from the east, which they were to follow far to the west until it stood over a Bethlehem outhouse. They don't see that. The Lord knows that. But they didn't see that. They don't see anything. They're blind and deaf and dumb and hopeless. But you see, long before then, Babylon was to be a hopeless ruin. Like stubble, says the prophet, it will be consumed. No fire to warm yourselves here in the cold of the desert nights, but a consuming fire, which, you remember, the writer to the Hebrews says, our God is a consuming fire. Judgment. Judgment. So, you see, that's the picture here in these two chapters. It's almost, if you're interested in art and modern art, it's almost like a kind of collage For the Lord's prophet stands, you see, at a particular point of history. Well, when? Say, round about the turn of the 700s, you see. 701, 700, 699, round about then. Yes, he's standing at that particular point of history. And he's looking forward 100 years to the Jews' captivity in Babylon. He sees right through that humiliating and shameful episode in Babylon to the subjection of Babylon at last by Cyrus. And you see, that Persian's will, Cyrus's will, God-inspired, sent the Jews back to Jerusalem. And all that is to happen to declining Babylon, to pay for what she did so wantonly to Jewry, will be seen. Not only so, but you see, the Lord adopts an even longer term perspective. You need a longer view here, a long lens, which is bound to take in, albeit silently, the Jews' hundreds of years of struggle to maintain their hold on Jerusalem. 500 years after their return to Jerusalem, they struggled to maintain their hold on that fevered and tortured city until Messiah came. And then when he came, what did they do with him? The hope of Israel and the hope of the world. They rejected him out of hand with no more discernment than a brick wall, leading, of course, as we know, to their great dispersion all over the globe. For nearly 2,000 years the Jews are scattered all over the face of the earth until 1948. But much longer and further than that, he sees with Jeremiah and John in the Revelation that this Babylon is simply the type of all ungodly rule which rears its head above all men and seeks to possess the world for its own seductive and destructive pleasure. One of the things which has been so maddening during the years of Soviet domination of half the world is that while queues are endemic in Marxist lands, her rulers themselves have lived in the lap of luxury against all the principles of Marxist-Leninist philosophy. You see, that alone, apart from the massacre of millions who were inconvenient to their crazy ideas, that alone is sufficient crime against their own people to incur the wrath of Almighty God and to call for a complete denouement of their offensive regimes. The collapse of 70-odd years of Marxist communism is, if it were not so serious, the laugh of the century. Ha ha! You wicked fools, we say today in 1989. Yes, we do. Ha ha! You wicked fools. And then we say to the people of Russia, and China too, and the Soviet satellites, we say this: you also, what has taken you that it has taken the world, your people, so long to see through the criminal folly of your leaders and rise up against it? Don't you think God in heaven is laughing loudly today at old Honecker, as the cream of his belabored nation flee as far from his horrid clutches as they can? Is that not a laugh in heaven? Are you applying your Bibles to history, to contemporary history? When you read the newspapers, do you understand them in the light of this book? Every day, several times a day in the news, we say, "Ah! God is in control. He takes his own time. But when he acts, does he not act?" The ecstasy alone, we've seen it in the television, the ecstasy alone of these people who have fled from Eastern Germany should turn Honecker in his alleged sick bed to weep tears of blood for all the suffering and humiliation and privation and needless oppression he has caused his people, just to uphold a mad theoretic ideal which bears no relation to human society but owes more to the world of caged beasts than to men. But think how long it has taken the worm to turn. 70 years and more. Astonishing. And you see, people with ethnic problems are just beginning to see what power is in their own hands if they dare to mass together against tyranny. And it will happen again in Tiananmen Square. But you see, all these years, someone else has been laughing. He's laughing in the other side of his face now, mind you, about this. But all these years he's been laughing, I mean the devil, at how easily hundreds of millions of souls have been lulled into passive endurance of these jack-booted tyrants, because the people neither had the courage nor the unity to mass themselves together into united resistance to tanks and machine guns. Why? In our recent experience, whole populations have faced guns and have seen their masters wilt before their united protests and have given way. And they're giving way. In Russia, in Poland, Eastern Germany, Hungary. But you see, it has taken nothing less than the sheer poverty of the Marxist regime itself to prove to the masses that this was no way to live, enduring unspeakable oppression while satellite countries were milked of their natural resources to finance the production of guns for world conquest instead of for bread and butter. And we could go on. This is the Bible. This is the Bible applied to 1989. But you see, I think particularly from the biblical point of view, we are living in a day when practically unknown to our masters, biblical principles are being wrought out in a most miraculous way. How far does our Prime Minister see this? How far does atheist Neil Kinnock see this? Would you like an atheist for your Prime Minister? Would you? Whatever his policy. Ask yourself that. You see, it is one thing to have lived through two world wars, including the revolution in Russia of 1917. I can still see as a boy the sad pictures, 1917, the sad pictures of the Russian royal family after we heard that they had been murdered. But you see, it's another thing to see the sure beginnings of the collapse of the communist hegemony, not to speak of an even more fearsome monster that I referred to in prayer to replace it, namely fanatical anti-Christian Islam with its new political party unashamedly intending to dominate our land, which will be a judgment on us and a judgment on Christ's church if it ever happens. The day that we have an Islamic prime member of parliament will be a day for us to fall on our faces and cry to God to have mercy on us for our sins. But you see, over against all that, the message to Judah in chapter 46, if she has the perceptive wit to take it in, is that the greatest thing she could possibly know about her welfare, beyond all punishment for her sins, by captivity or other penalty, the greatest thing she could know about her welfare is that since the birth of her nation, unto all eternity, she is cradled in the arms of her loving God, and he will never let her go. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, he says. That's her sinful name. All you who remain of the house of Israel, that's her saintly name. You whom I have upheld since you were conceived, that was surely before the worlds began, and have carried you, not like the discredited Babylonian idols were carried by beasts of burden. I have carried you since your birth, even to your old age and gray hairs. I am he who will sustain you. I have made you and I will carry you. I will sustain you and rescue you. To whom then will you compare me? He's appealing to them, but they're going to go astray and go to Babylon after that. But he's appealing to them. Oh, he says, look ahead and see what's ahead of you. Turn from your idols, that's what he's saying. Turn from your idols. To whom then will you compare me or count me equal? What an appeal to a nation in Isaiah's time, already clean gone on idols. What an appeal. Would that not appeal to them if they understood what he's saying? Does it appeal to you? And to me, sufficiently to determine the course of our future life, is the fact that as a believer, you are cradled in the Lord's arms and are as safe as Top Lady says, as if you were in heaven. Is that not going to affect your daily life? That's the question as we sing our last hymn. 459, thou hidden love of God, whose height, whose depth unfathomed, no man knows, I see from far thy beauteous light. Inly I sigh for thy repose. My heart is pained, nor can it be at rest till it finds rest in thee. 459.